from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Yaa Jessie was born in Ghana and came to America when she was two. She grew up in Alabama, went to Stanford, studied at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Now she's out with a debut novel, Homegoing, that is getting a lot of attention. It traces the descendants of two sisters, half-sisters, in Ghana, one who was sold as a slave to America, one who stayed in Africa. This hour On Point, Yaa Jessie's Homegoing. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is slavery in your family story? African Americans, have you imagined life, your family story, without it? African immigrants, how does it inform your experience? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll look at the remake of the blockbuster miniseries from the 70s, Roots. It is back. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Yaa Jessie, 26 years old, born in Ghana, raised in Huntsville, Alabama. Her novel is Homegoing. Ta-Nehisi Coates writes, "This is the epic of the slave trade in all its ugly discomfort. Nobody clean, nobody pure." Yaa Jessie, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be on.
What's Ta-Nehisi Coates pointing to there? Nobody clean, nobody pure. We dip into this book, and it's not as simple as white slavers on the coast, slaves sold into misery, and everything just fine and dandy back on the African continent.
Yeah, I think that Coates is talking about the way that this book kind of delves into African complicity in the slave trade, which is something that we don't talk about very often. Particularly, I think West Africans have a habit of not talking about it as often. In my own country, in Ghana, there's this huge monument to slavery on the coast. And yet, we never got to see the result of it. We never got to see what became of the slaves who were taken away. And so in a way, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And yet there was this role that we played in the slave trade. And bringing that to light and also showing how the two sides, the Ghanaian side and the African American side, might be connected was definitely something that I wanted to do with this novel.
We learn it in your novel Homegoing through, to start with, a couple of characters, half sisters, Efia and Essie. Introduce us to them and their separate fates.
Sure. So Efia is an Ashanti.
And we're talking late 1700s here, I guess.
Yes, late 1700s. Mm-hmm. Efia is Afanti, excuse me. She lives in the coast of what was then called the Gold Coast, which is now referred to as Ghana. And she is growing up in a village that kind of becomes wrapped up in the slave trade. The new chief of her village has decided that he wants to participate in the slave trade by having his village be one of the stopping points down the path towards the Cape Coast Castle, which is a slave castle in Ghana.
There were many. It's a big one. Many Americans may have visited there. It's sort of famous,
right,
at this point.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's quite famous. I think Obama was there in 2009. Mm-hmm. So it's become a stopping point for many tourists and many African Americans who are kind of trying to trace their roots back. Efia basically is given in a marriage to James Collins, who is the governor of the Cape Coast Castle. He's the British governor of the Cape Coast Castle. So she marries him, and her descendants, they grow up enmeshed in the slave trade and participating in the slave trade and also trying to escape their participation in the slave trade. Unbeknownst to her, her half-sister Essie, who is an Ashanti, is captured from her own village and marched down through Afia's village and into the castle, where she is kept before being taken through the Middle Passage to America.
There's a moment in the book, perhaps you'd read for us, when she's recently arrived at the Cape Coast Castle and she's taking it all in, and her white British brand new husband is there. Would you read just a bit from Homegoing?
Sure. She breathed everything in, stopping at the gun platform that held huge black cannons facing out toward the sea. She wanted to rest before James led her up his private stairwell, and so she laid her head down against one of those cannons for just a moment. Then she felt a breeze hit her feet from small holes in the ground. "What's below?" she asked James, and the mangled Fanti word that came back to her was cargo. Then, carried up with the breeze, came a faint crying sound, so faint Afia thought she was imagining it, until she lowered herself down, rested her ear against the grate. "James, are there people down there?" she asked. Quickly, James came to her. He snatched her up from the ground and grabbed her shoulders, looking straight into her eyes. "Yes," he said evenly. It was the one Fanti word he had mastered.
And so she comes to know or suspect, or I guess know, something of what's going on down there. Step away from the story for just one moment. What were the dimensions of complicity? You speak of a village that you include in the book that was a way station, but it was more than that. There was the active taking of slaves. What were the dimensions of complicity that you know from your study of Ghanaian history here?
Right. There was the active taking of slaves. In particular, I think there was this exploitation on the part of many of the Europeans who were seeking slaves of the different ethnic groups' rivalries. Mm-hmm. And so the British were allied with the Ashanti, with the Fanti, and the Dutch were allied with the Ashanti.
The Ashanti, the inland, and Afanti more on the coast.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And these two ethnic groups were old rivals. And numerous different ethnic groups had different rivalries. And so once those groups started to war with each other or had conflict, when they captured people during those wars, they would often sell them to the British. Or keep them for themselves. And so slavery was a part of the Gold Coast at that time, both internally and then also from the selling of these slaves to the Europeans who sold them, you know, across the world.
And war in that matrix became a kind of economic enterprise because war meant the opportunity for slave taking.
Exactly, exactly.
Were these stories that you grew up with, or did you, I'm not sure what brought your family to the States, but were these kitchen table conversations, or did you have to plunge back in and learn all this for yourself? Yeah.
These were not kitchen table conversations. My family came to America when my father was getting his PhD in French at Ohio State. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he's always been interested in French and Francophone African literature. And there were conversations around colonialism, certainly, but not as it pertained to Ghanaian involvement in the slave trade. I became interested in it in college when I kind of started to think more about diaspora. You know, I'd grown up in Alabama, and yet I had this this different background. I was an immigrant, not an African American, mm-hmm. and so culturally there were a lot of things that separated me, and a lot of ways that I didn't really connect to the American story of slavery. And I wanted to kind of figure out what my side of the story might be. And so I traveled to Ghana in 2009 on a grant from Stanford in order to do research for this novel, and that was the first time that I went to the Cape Coast Castle. And while I was there, the tour guide started to mention things that I had never heard, including the fact that the British soldiers who lived and worked in the castle would sometimes marry the local women. And this really kind of opened up the door for this entire novel.
Yeah, Jesse, we have callers for you. There's a lot more we want to learn about the story in the background, but let's take one. Bassie's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Bassie, you're on the air with Jesse in Berkeley, California.
Thank you, Tom. I wanted to comment on the premise of the author's narrative that Africans were complicit in the slave trade. And that may well be true, but it's troubling that historians, when telling the story, seem to blame the entire slave trade on this complicity of other Africans. All through history, it is well documented that whenever there are conflicts or adverse events in history, that victims of those events have taken part in their own complicity. in their own victimization. This is well documented. But they should not be blamed altogether for the events. We see this even up until today. We have Iraqis in Iraq killing themselves, but they cannot be blamed for having started the war in Iraq. The same thing during the Second World War. Jews, it's well documented, took part in their own victimization, but no one will blame them today for the Holocaust. So I disagree with the author for making the statement that Africans are complicit and don't want to talk about it. It's just not fair.
But Basi, let us pick it up. I think in fairness, she does point to the complicity, but she doesn't at all ignore that it was white slavers at the coast who created the market for these slaves. Yeah, how do you respond to Basi's concern?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the book makes it clear that slavery was largely a European enterprise, a European and American enterprise, and that you know, the Ghanaians who were involved in it were kind of just wrapped up in something much larger than perhaps they even understood at the time. So the complicity aspect of it isn't something that I think necessitates placing blame on the West Africans. But it is something that I think should be talked about, especially if you're going to tell a fully rounded story about the slave trade, which is what I wanted to do with this book.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a tale of two African sisters, half-sisters, one of whose descendants stay in Africa, one who's sold a slave to America, and the stories of their families as imagined by debut novelist Yah Jessie in her first book, Homegoing. Behind us, waves crash on the shore in front of Cape Coast Castle, one of about 40 slave castles built on the coast of what is now Ghana by European slave traders. A little sound from Accra, Ghana, in the evening. Her book traces all the way from the late 1700s right up to contemporary times. This is in Accra, jazz singer in an open-air club called the 233 Jazz Bar and Grill. This was captured by a video blogger just a few weeks ago. Sound of Ghana today, here in an appearance on Sway in the Morning on Sirius XM last Wednesday. Chicago rapper, poet Common, on the American side of this fork in the road, reciting a verse from a song he's working on for an upcoming release called Black America Again.
Trayvon will never get to be an older man. Black children, they childhood stole from them, robbed of our names and our language, stole again. Who stole the soul from black folk? Same man that stole the land from cheap black smoke and made the whip crackle on our back slow, made us go through the back door and raffle black bodies on the slave blocks. Now we slaves.
Yeah, Jesse's debut novel, Homegoing, describes that fork in the road. One half-sister sold in the slave trade to America. The other stays in Ghana. The weight of slavery, though, weighs on both. But they're very different paths, and their descendants go in, of course, very different histories over the generations that follow. She tells it all in this book. You can join us, hour. Does the framework of this story grab you? And what do we learn when we look back on these paths, those who stayed in Africa, those who came in chains? Was this your family's story? Which side? Yeah, Jesse joins us from Berkeley, California. You write a little bit of the one half-sister, Afia, upstairs in the castle, married now to a white British, the governor of the castle, a slave trader by definition, below in a kind of dungeon is the other half-sister. And her fate will take her on the Middle Passage across the Atlantic to slavery in America, Essie. People are dying around her. Could you read a little bit of that terrible scene down below? Yeah.
Sure. By morning, Afua had died. Her skin was purple and blue, and Essie knew that she had held her breath until Nyame took her. They would all be punished for this. The soldiers came in, though Essie was no longer able to tell what time. The mud walls of the dungeon made all time equal. There was no sunlight. Darkness was day and night, and everything in between. Sometimes there were so many bodies stacked into the women's dungeon that they all had to lie stomach down so that women could be stacked on top of them. It was one of those days. Essie was kicked to the ground by one of the soldiers, his foot at the base of her neck so that she couldn't turn her head to breathe anything but the dust and detritus from the ground. The new women were brought in, and some were wailing so hard that the soldiers smacked them unconscious. They were piled on top of the other women, their bodies dead weight. When the smacked ones came to, there were no more tears.
Yeah, what about this side of the story? Was this family conversation for you as a Ghanaian-American growing up in Alabama?
Yes, this was definitely the more familiar side of the story. As you say, my family grew up, or I grew up in Alabama. I moved there when I was 9 years old. And so it is, you know, the home that I know most, certainly more than I know Ghana, which I left when I was two. Mm-hmm. And so the experience of being black in Alabama really informed this book and also made me think a lot more critically, I think, than I might have otherwise about what it means to be a descendant of a slave, what it means to have this legacy just that you carry on your back for hundreds and hundreds of years.
You follow these two branches of the family then, one staying in Ghana, one that starts in slavery or goes to slavery in America across hundreds of years. And, of course, there's the slavery chapter, there's Civil War, there's chain gangs and Jim Crow and lynchings, the Great right. Migration North, the American side of that, of those chapters, one after another, we know fairly well. The Ghanaian side, not so well. What does that side of those centuries of descent look like? What are the milestones?
Sure. On the Ghanaian side, you know, I talk about the advent of cocoa farming in the Gold Coast. There's also the numerous Ashanti Anglo Wars. I particularly talk about the Ya Santwa War of 1900, which was a major war, and the Ashanti lost, and it was also the last war that kind of made it so that the Ashanti were finally absorbed into the British Empire. I also talk about the beginnings of independence in Ghana. There's a character named Yao who is a teacher who is very much pro-independence and is a part of the independence movement in Ghana and in the 1950s. And so I kind of take you through all of these different milestones in Ghanaian history.
Do you see them, feel them as throughout informed by, I don't know what you would call it, the original sin of slavery?
Yeah, I think I do see them as at least in conversation with the original sin of slavery. You know, slavery is part of why the Europeans stayed as long as they did. And, you know, it extends past that, obviously, and they stayed for much longer than slavery continued. But you know, I think the two things are intertwined, colonialism and slavery. And I think, you know, it's worth exploring them as a conversation.
Al in Charleston, South Carolina. Al, you're on the air with Jesse.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
I'm very interested in this subject and would like to read the author's new book, Homegoing.
Mm-hmm. Homegoing.
Right, Homegoing. Yeah, it's like death in the African-American community. One mm-hmm. talks about the homegoing ceremony, mm-hmm. Which are basically funerals. I wanted to find out, though, whether the author points out in her narrative that the guns that slave ports like
Cape Coast.
She's talking mm-hmm. about Cape Coast and Elmina point inland as well as out to sea so that mm-hmm. the fort is being protected from those who would oppose this trade in Africa as well as those who might try to take it over from the sea.
Yeah, in the brief bit that you read for us, you've got the cannons pointing out to sea, but Al, it sounds like you may have been there and see some pointing both ways.
Right. Well, there's no mention, I suppose, in the book of the cannons that point inland, but there is mention of threats to the castle via these wars, these Anglo-Ashanti wars. And so it was very much true, I think, that you know, they were trying to protect their interests at the coast, the British were. And so the cannons pointed both ways.
Al, may I ask you, there in Charleston, when you visited, and in your life, do you ever, maybe
25 years ago.
Do you meditate, Alan?
Yeah, I was a part of a group from the African American Institute, which was started by African American scholars, I guess, during the 1940s, and it continued, like AMSAC and other groups associated with African culture, to develop contacts between African Americans and Africa. And so that's how I took that trip. I worked there for a time as well, but it was an interesting part of my experience that there was a long, long war, or there were long wars fought by Africans against the slave trade once they found out what they had been duped into. And there are many African heroes of that era who were anti-slave African warriors.
Al, Yah talks about a cultural separation that she felt coming as a young Ghanaian to the United States and growing up here. What about you when you were in Ghana? Did you feel a cultural separation? What did you make of it?
Oh, I'm an American, and I remember my ties to America. I feel my ties to America as an American, but I'm also associated with Africa. And because I'm associated, that occurred because of my background in America. After growing up in an environment that was rigidly segregated and that had a that attempted to degrade Africa, one was naturally interested in those things that uplifted Africa. And there had been this history that I learned when I went to college at Howard University in Washington, where you had scholars who were exploring African history. And so we were, this is an interesting thing because it has to do with African-American identity and African identity in the current world environment. You know, who are these African people? What do they stand for? And so it's very important for us to look at every aspect of that history. And that was one of the reasons I went to Ghana.
Alice, I so appreciate your call. Thank you very much for it and for taking us there. Yeah. Yeah, what about that cultural gap? How do you see it, having come from a family of Ghanaians and grown up here? This is a lot of history that you describe in different directions. You can have the same route and end up in quite different places after all those different experiences. How do you see the gap? How do you describe it?
Yeah, well, for me and for my family, I think, it had a lot to do with the fact that when we came to America, we kind of ended up always living in predominantly white spaces. Our side of town in Huntsville is predominantly white. My schools were predominantly white. And so we had kind of less contact with African-American communities. And so
this is because your dad had his PhD and he was in that world, I guess? Or...
Well, yeah. I don't know if that was exactly the reason. I think there was, in Huntsville, the schools were better on the southeast side, and that just happened to be the whiter side of Huntsville.
If it just happened to be, but I don't doubt that it was.
No, there's a long yeah. history there as well. But that was the side that we ended up living on because of the schools, and so I think we didn't have as many cultural touchstones, and we didn't have as many like connections to African American communities. And so we were kind of having to learn it all on our own. I remember getting to Stanford and hearing a Nina Simone song for the first time, played by a friend of mine, a black friend of mine. And she was shocked to learn that I didn't know who Nina Simone was. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, that's not a part of my culture. And so, you know, I was kind of constantly navigating these gaps and trying to learn about diaspora broadly, trying to learn how we all fit together.
Ahijo is calling from Snellville, Georgia. Ahijo, you're on the air with Jesse.
Yes, hi, Tom. I just have one comment to make here regarding the complicity of the Africans as far as the slave trade was concerned, as described by the author. Mm-hmm. Actually, I come from Cameroon, which is a Francophone country, and growing up, we learned that most African chiefs, especially those from the coast, were involved in buying guns, you know, to control the land. And who had the guns? The Europeans. And that was one of the incentives, you know, to encourage the slave trade among Africans themselves. So guns and, you know, in order to control vast part of the land. And again, that goes to the economic point that aspect that the author just mentioned. And my second point is that, you know, coming to America, when you leave your country as a black, as an African, there's a belief that once you get here, you're going to be in tune very much with your own, you know, with your African-American brothers and sisters that left, you know, centuries ago. But again, the divide in the culture is so wide that it's usually very hard for Africans to fit in, you know, into the African American culture. There's a mutual, distancing between those two cultures, which is very, very difficult for someone else to comprehend or to understand. And I have so many examples of that. So mostly Africans, when they come to America, they live among Africans and with their white friends, I should say, other cultures. So that's my comment, and I thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Ahijo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What about it, Yah? A mutual distancing? Have you felt that?
I think, you know, it's different for me because I immigrated so young. It was easier for me, I think, to assimilate than it was for my parents. And I think, you know, when you grow up in a country where race is not really the issue. Race is not how you think of yourself, how you construct your relationships with other people.
That is Ghana, you mean?
Right, in Ghana. So, you know, my father, you know, grew up as an Ashanti in the Ashanti region. If you asked him to describe himself, I'm sure he would say that he was an Ashanti first and then a Ghanaian and then a West African and then an African. And it would take a long time before he got to the word black. Whereas here in America, that's very different. And so I think that's a part of the distance, you know, kind of having to learn to navigate how America thinks about race, which is hard, I think, for a lot of black immigrants when they come to wrap their heads around how to do that.
Would you hear your mother, your father, I don't know, sometimes shake their heads and say, wait, what's going on here in this country? US?
Yeah, definitely. I think lots of instances they would shake their heads and wonder what exactly is going on here. How do we talk to our children about what's going on here? You know, in cases of kind of explicit racism, if one of us came home having been called the N-word, for example, how do you talk to your children about that when that word doesn't exist in your home country?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Behind me there, Ghanaian woman producer and reggae dancehall musician Shatta Whale, big in Ghana right now. This is his 2016 hit single, Baby Chop Kiss. My guest today is Yah Jesse. Her new book is Home Going. It's the story of two half-sisters separated way back in Africa. One who stays in Ghana, one who goes to the new world in chains as a slave. She follows their descendants down many generations to trace the long, long tale of the impact, the import of that enslavement. The book's getting a pretty rapturous reception. She joins us today from Berkeley, California. Born in Ghana, raised most of her childhood in Alabama. You can join us this hour. African Americans, do you feel heard by this daughter of Africa and America? Which fork in this road did your family take? Before this hour is out, we'll look at the new rendition of Roots, which has just come out in the last week or so, the remake of the 1970s mega hit. How do these issues echo down through the years? Well, loudly. Here from May 25th, this is a Harvard University graduate delivering a spoken word commencement speech focused on racial inequality. Talk about the African-American experience. This went viral. Donovan Livingston spoke to fellow classmates, 2016 grads from Harvard's Graduate School of Education, about what it means to be black at Harvard.
For some, the only difference between a classroom and a plantation is time. How many times must we be made to feel like quotas, like tokens and coin phrases, diversity, inclusion? There are days I feel like one, like only, a lonely blossom in a briar patch of broken promises. But hey, I've always been a thorn in the side of injustice.
Yeah, Jesse joins us from Berkeley. Yeah, you can hear the burden there. This African-American grad from Harvard, he was still carrying this sense of burden.
Right.
Do you have it? Having come from the other fork in this road, having you know, it was your family was the one of the families that stayed in Africa, and I wonder if that burden just isn't so palpable, or maybe it is.
You know, I don't know if the burden is as palpable as African Americans who have the legacy from coming to this country in chains, and yet I grew up mostly here, and I grew up mostly in Alabama, and so the effects of slavery, the legacy of slavery, is still pretty strongly felt there, and so I feel a huge connection, I suppose, to the African American experience, and still like a lot of grief and a lot of rage and all of those complicated emotions that come along with it.
By the time these forks in the families that you trace, kind of bend toward one another again, are these people now all in America, people who recognize each other? Does the story shine through, or is it clouded? Is it hard to have transparency in the conversation between family members whose forks have taken such different paths?
You know, I think it is clouded. I think sometimes it's hard to see the other side. You know, you can go to Ghana as an African American and feel like a stranger, and you can come to America from Ghana and feel like a stranger when you meet an African American. So I think there is this kind of opaqueness, I suppose, and yet I think the conversation is open and it's you know kind of ripe to be had, and so hopefully this book kind of opens it up even more.
Daniel in Buffalo, New York. Daniel, you're on the air with Wad. Yeah, Jesse.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Before I ask my question, I just wanted to commend the writer for starting this conversation. I'm from Nigeria, so I've always been interested in this side of slavery. But we don't talk about it at all. I just wanted to commend her for starting the conversation through her book.
Thank you.
My question is, did she find enough resources when she went to Ghana, when she was doing her research? Because in Nigeria, we, you know, basically our library system is just really bad and epileptic. I couldn't find books. I couldn't find anything. I just wanted to know how her research was when she went to Ghana.
Yeah.
Sure. My research in Ghana was primarily just about getting a sense for what it feels like to be there, just on the ground in Ghana. Because I wasn't raised there, I know it, but I know it through this filtered lens. And so I wanted to, if I was going to write about it, I wanted to feel as though I knew it wholly and completely. The primary part of my research was going to the Cape Coast Castle, taking the tour, talking to the tour tour guide. That was really the seed for me. And then when I came back to America was when I started to go to libraries and visit different research sources in that way, particularly a book called The Door of No Return by William St. Clair that talked about life in and around the castle during the time period that I'm writing about.
Daniel, I appreciate your call. Homegoing, our caller Al in Charleston noted, of course, that this is related to the almost like funeral for African Americans in usage. How do you understand the term and the way you're applying it as the title of your book? Yeah.
Right. Historically, this term homegoing is associated with African American funerals, in the sense that there was this belief that once you died, your soul could finally return to your home country, return to African soil. For me, that title was particularly resonant because my two characters do return to Ghana at the end of this book, and kind of have that sense of homegoing, of homecoming, and you know, kind of being supported by a full rounded family.
What do you hope people take from the story of the fork in the road that slavery made in this family and all that ensued?
Well, one thing that I hope people take from it is just the understanding that these events happened to individuals just like us, people with hopes and dreams and fears like we have, not just a nameless, faceless mass of people who underwent the effects of slavery. And so hopefully this book puts names and faces to these situations.
It does. And over centuries, it's pretty compelling, getting a big reception. It's just out today. Yeah, Jesse, we wish you good luck. Debut novel, that's a big deal. We congratulate you, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Yeah, Jesse, born in Ghana, raised mainly in Huntsville, Alabama. Her new novel is Homegoing. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, Roots for a New Generation. 4 decades after the Alex Haley miniseries captivated the nation, the story has been reimagined. This is On Point. The 1977 TV miniseries Roots told the story of a young African man, Kunta Kinte, sold into slavery in America. It was adapted from the Alex Haley novel, and on Memorial Day, the History Channel debuted its take on the classic. The new Roots aired over 4 nights from May 30th through June 2nd. The goal was to reimagine the story to reach a new audience. Here's from the new Roots. Kunta Kinte, played by Malachi Kirby, is told, trying to hold on to his identity as the plantation overseer Connolly, played by Tony Curran, beats him because he won't answer to the new name he's been given.
Your name is Toby. Now tell me your name.
I'm Kunta Kinte.
That's not your name. Toby's your name. Now what is your name?
Kunta Kinte.
The new Roots from the History Channel, joining me now from Atlanta for perspective on the new showing is Stephanie Dunn, Associate Professor, Director of the Cinema, Television, and Emerging Media Studies Program at Morehouse College. She's author of Bad Bitches and Sassy Super Mamas. Stephanie Dunn, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
It's always hard to listen to that whip come down. What do you make of the new Roots, and how's it like and unlike the original that was such a sensation in this country decades now ago?
Wow. I think that it was, as I said in my article about it, that I thought that it was an important step to remake it and that it was timely. But, of course, it is vastly different, and it was supposed to be because the executive producer, whose father produced the first Roots, wanted to make it so that it would visually, I think, and in terms of production value, speak to this current generation in a way that the sort of, I think, dated look perhaps of the 1977 Roots no longer did.
Describe it just visually, Stephanie. What is that difference? How have tastes or techniques changed? What's the difference in the visual presentation that comes across?
Sure. I think one of the things that you will note in the current roots is just really the use of even color when we talk about the costumes. And, of course, the great costume designer Ruth Carter was led the team that did the designing for the new roots. But there's this sort of difference in terms of the treatment even of the colors that you will see the enslaved draped in throughout the miniseries. But it's also about, you know, production value in terms of what was possible now and that wasn't in 1977. So, you can see the bigger budget in terms of the technology, the technological sort of uses mm-hmm. now that makes this a very brilliantly sort of vivid reimagining to look at. And things like makeup, for example, which I think now when you watch the 1977 roots, and when I watched it even years later as a really young adult, I kind of laughed because the way that they aged the black folk on the original roots was a little absurd. And I understood they were trying to make the transition in time, right? Mm-hmm. But it was really heavy-handed.
I mean, and sort of rudimentary techniques of makeup and all.
A little bit there. Yeah. It looked superficial, you know, in a way.
Yeah, but it hardly mattered at the time. It made such an impact. It was such a breakthrough. Here's just a little bit from the 1977 miniseries. Kunta Kinte, the main character, has just been born in Africa. His father's brought him outside to name him under the stars.
You are Kunta Kinte, son of Moran Dinta Kinte, grandson of Kairaba Kunta Kinte and Yaisa. You must always honor your ancestors, the ones who love you and watch over you. Your name is your spirit. Your name is your shield.
Stephanie, forgive me. That's from the new Roots presentation. Your name is your spirit. Your name is your shield. Does a different sensibility just roll on from there? Is there a different treatment of how the experience is understood, emerge in the new one?
I don't think so. I think here's the thing that is the same, and that is the truth of the story. The truth of the story, both the beauties, the trauma, the difficult sojourn of a family, right, in what was just an extremely sort of tragic and brutal, mm-hmm. right, journey mm-hmm. from Africa to here, that remains the same. Roots 1977, Roots 2016. Mm-hmm. And I think just the power in which Haley drew, you know, this portrait, and the fact that he was able to put those pieces together, you know, pieces that remain broken for so many African Americans who have not yet been able to trace back our histories in quite that way. So that still resonates and travels from 77 to the 2016 version. I think what is different in some ways is not only the look, but it's the nuances of the story that were tapped in this new one. For example, there is a little bit more sort of, I think, trying to show and tease out life in Africa before the Middle Passage.
Mm-hmm.
So we see a little bit more treatment even in terms of the Africans and, you know, their relationship with guns and getting the guns right from the Europeans. And we see about a little bit about Kunta Kinte's family and the rituals of, moving from boyhood to manhood and just sort of a kind of a different little way. We see things like him wanting to go, you know, he wants to go study at Timbuktu.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that we would have imagined something like that being an aspect of being spoken to in the original, you know, that this conflict between he and the family, when he does, become a man, he doesn't just want to settle down, you know, mm-hmm. right, and take his place in the village. He wants to go study at the greatest learning center in the world.
And, of course, there were great libraries in Timbuktu back in the day. Does it still feel revelatory, or does it feel at this point we know this history and now we're just taking another walk through it?
we do not know this history. My argument is that what we know is that this history existed. But because in American culture, and I think largely this goes from education to popular culture, we have consistently not gone there into what even Quentin Tarantino, when he did Django, called, you know, slavery, you know, hell, right? Mm-hmm. We have consistently refused to go to, quote, the hell of slavery in this country. So there has been relatively little treatment, if you will, of slavery in popular culture. And I think that we might get a little bit confused because Underground is on WGN and there's this Roots remake. Nate Parker's Birth of a Nation is about to come out, and we think we've dealt with slavery, but we have not.
It all comes back in remade form in the latest version of Roots from the History Channel. Stephanie Dunn, thanks for looking at it for a minute with us today. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Stephanie Dunn, Professor, Director of the Cinema, Television, and Emerging Media Studies Program at Morehouse College. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Ashley Bailey, Sarah Ernst, Dina Kleiner, and Virginia Marshall. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.